The case before us today is the United States v. Joseph Management and SDH Properties. The United States has waived oral arguments, so we will start oral argument with the Josephson Management and Sushi Deli side. So whoever would like to start first among the two co-appellants is fine with the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Louis E. Goble appearing on behalf of Sushi Deli.
How are you and your co-counsel going to split the time? 20 minutes between you.
We're going to split it to half and half, and I would request to reserve 5 minutes of my 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Just watch the clock.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yes, the clock is a countdown clock. It should be right there to your right.
Okay.
And that tells you the number of minutes and seconds that are remaining.
We'll go quickly, and that'll lead to my opening remarks. Is that we have briefed the matter, and I'm not going to go through the briefing, but I'd like to jump around a little bit and hit some of the points that perhaps. A little more practical and can be additional help beyond the briefing.
Are you and Josephson in the same position, except to the extent that you have different leases? Is that essentially where you are in terms of interpretation?
Yeah, you've anticipated one of my arguments. Despite my being a colleague of counsel here, we are different in one respect on our leases.
Very good.
And, of course, we believe that our lease is clearer and more compelling, not to degrade theirs in any way, but it just seems to be black and white that we were entitled to a proportion of the overall pie, so to speak. And that's my next step, is that, as I think the courts learned, but just to reinforce it, these cases go into two phases, and the first phase is effectively to create the pie, and when the pie is created, the taker, which in this case happens to be the government, is free to leave, and then the second phase goes to the remaining parties to split the pie, cut it up into pieces. And happily for both myself and my counsel here, there wasn't any splitting of the pie. The owner, late coming owner to Tibet, took the whole thing.
Well, the United States makes its condemnation award to the owner of the building, and then the question is to what extent that award should be allocated after it's received by the landlord, between the landlord and the tenant. That's what we're dealing with here.
Well, I would differ just slightly with that, Your Honor. I'd like to clarify it.
All right.
Sharpen it up a little bit. The idea is that the entire fee interest is being valued.
Right.
As if it were vacant.
Yes, of course.
And then the parties, as from there on, you're right on. You go on and divide it up, and in some cases there may be situations where the division is non-contractual, but in this case, at least as to Sushi Deli, the division was contractual. And you know, I'm sure you've gone through the language there that shows that we were entitled to our pro rata share of the pie that had been created.
That's in 17B of the lease.
Yes. And actually, I think that the trial judge even recognized that at one point in his decision. Unfortunately, 10 pages later, he got kind of off the track a little bit.
Well, where exactly did Judge Singleton go wrong?
Looking back, in effect, going back to the first phase of the trial, the making the pie, and making a judgment about whether this building was how long this building was going to last. We had a pie here, and his job the pie was created by, in this case, not by trial, but by a settlement. the owner settled with the government. So we have the pie. He's not really properly allowed to go back to revisit the making of the pie. What he needs to do is to divide up on a contractual basis between the owner and the tenants. And that's what didn't happen here. His concept was, this building is old and not going to last very long. It may or may not. We all know about buildings that don't look great or historic and go on forever. But this particular tenant made a contract with the predecessor to this owner to take care of that, to say, if anything happens to this building, like being taken by the government, for example, then I get my share.
Now, is your position that he undervalued the leasehold interest or that he discarded it entirely?
Well, he discarded it entirely. We had an experienced real estate appraiser value it at $469,000. We didn't get a penny. So
was that testimony in front of him?
Yes, absolutely. And it looks like my time has passed here.
Very fine, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Berwanger, is that correct?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Charles Berwanger. I'm with the firm of Gordon and Reese, and my clients are Josephson Management Company and JS Foods. If it pleases the Court, Your Honors, my view of the case, to give emphasis to what our message is that Judge Singleton erred in two ways in reading paragraph 12.3 to our lease. And we have a different lease than Sushi Deli. He erred because his reading rendered half of the language of 12.3 surplusage. And if I may, if I'd like to reserve, say, 2 minutes to respond to Mr. Ball. His reading rendered half of the language of 12.3 surplusage. Plus, he read into the provision language which is not fairly imputable to the 12.3. He read into 12.3 a requirement that the government must be the payee, the condemnor, and he read into the provision the law of eminent domain. That was not the intention of the parties. That is not the way the language reads. And if I may just focus for a second on the language. Josephson insisted, and we've highlighted for you in our briefs, the negotiations that took place in 1988 in which Mr. Josephson was looking towards building a Burger King in a dilapidated building, and he wanted protection for his $670,000 investment. So he insisted that, and this is 12.3, that tenant shall receive a sum attributable to the undepreciated value of FF&E and TIs. That phrase, undepreciated value, is pivotal. Four elements compel the conclusion that it means cost, the tenant's cost in putting those improvements in, not value depreciated by wear and tear and obsolescence. First, undepreciated means you don't take anything away from it. We have cited in a reply brief at pages 15 to 18 the American Appraisal Institute's analysis that I think bears on the question. And there's also a California Court of Appeal case that also lends credence to our analysis. Undepreciated value means cost. Secondly, paragraph 15 provides for an award, a payment by the landlord to the tenant of the undepreciated value of the business. Again, the same concept. But it makes it clear that the amount of money we're talking about is very significant. It puts a lid of $1.5 million on the landlord's obligation. Now, that's relevant to 12.3 because it means the parties understood that we're talking about a whole lot of money. We're not just talking about the bits and pieces that you get in eminent domain proceeding as occurred here. We're talking about the landlord paying money. And we're talking about cost. Thirdly, the landlord's interpretation, and I've lost track of time, the landlord's interpretation renders the award zero. That's a necessary consequence of the application of the landlord's formula, the landlord's reading of 12.3. And indeed, if you take back the reading to 1988 when the lease was written, and after Josephson spent some money, a whole lot of money, Josephson would have been entitled to zero as of the execution of the lease and the spending of a whole lot of money to improve the premises. Final point, given that the undepreciated value means cost, necessarily the money has to come from the landlord, because there is no law, there will never be any law, that a governmental agency in an eminent domain proceeding has to pay cost. That's just, it's not the way it works. So necessarily, 12.3 contemplated that the landlord would pay the money, the cost.
In other words, you're saying that these provisions were not meant simply to codify existing law. These were specifically
correct.
Negotiated provisions made between the landlord and the tenants as part of the decision as to whether to locate there.
Precisely. We're in the world of contract law now. We're not in the world of eminent domain law. So that's my reading. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Your side has almost 10 minutes left, so you can allocate it any way you wish.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the landlord.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Hodge Dahl, Dahl and Dahl, representing SDH, and I'm being helped today by Thomas Garson, Esquire. Just as a brief observation with some levity, maybe after hearing argument, it may have been this case should have been entitled United States versus Marie Callender's, because it is indeed about a pie, and it's about what's in the pie that's important in this entire case. Where I think appellants go wrong is here. In the first part of an eminent domain, you all are entitled to present evidence that there is value to this package, to this pie. As this case turned out, only two parties chose that option. Only SDH Properties, the owners of the property, and the government chose to present evidence that there is value to the property.
Well, now, wait a minute. We're not involved in reviewing an eminent domain proceeding. Here we're interpreting the provisions of leases. And I don't see how there's any duty on the part of these tenants to somehow participate in an eminent domain proceeding. They have no claim against the government.
Well, Your Honor, here's my point. Everybody who's a defendant in an eminent domain case has a claim against the government. For example, these tenants got fixtures and equipment paid for by the government. That was a claim against the government. And my thesis is, if you're going to say the building has value, neither the owner nor the government believed that, nor did their appraisers. If you're going to say the building has value, you must present evidence that the building has value. This judge was faced with reading appraisals that said the building had absolutely no contributory value, and therefore the pie had no ingredients that would pay for fixtures, for brick in the ground. There was nothing in the award for those things. So if the contract between these parties was a special contract that had nothing to do with eminent domain, that is, whether the award contains anything for the building, even though we know you put a lot of money in the inside of this building, but I'm going to say, as the landlord, and SDH's predecessor may have said this, I don't know why they put it in a condemnation clause in a lease, but if SDH's predecessor said, look, no matter what happens, whether there's any money in this condemnation award or not, I will nonetheless pay you exactly what you paid for what you put into that restaurant.
Well, isn't that part of the negotiating process?
Your Honor, it may well be. I mean, the mystery is, why did they put it in the condemnation clause? Why did the words allocated to come up all the time? Why did the words awarded for The government awards. Allocation is of an award. And if there's nothing in the award.
Look at seven. Here's what's bothering me. Okay. I'm looking at 17B of the Sushi Deli lease, and it says all awards for the taking of any part of the premises or any payment made under the threat of exercise of power of eminent domain, that's what we have here, shall be the property of both the landlord and the tenant in proportion to the respective possessory interests of the premises, whether made as compensation for the taking of the fee or as severance damages. I mean, that's a pretty clear statement, is it not, that some part of what the landlord receives, because the United States is only dealing with the landlord, has to be allocated between the landlord and the tenant.
I believe that is correct. That's what that says. But let's go on to what the evidence was. The evidence was what I am entitled to, Sushi Deli says, is I'm entitled to the value of occupancy of this property, which is below the market. And they presented an appraiser who indeed testified the value of the property occupancy is below the market. The judge did not believe that. He did not believe the testimony.
Did the Judge Singleton specifically make findings of fact with respect to the value, the bonus value of the lease?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. I think that would be most clearly pointed out in, give me just a moment. I believe page 0184 of the record is the quote of the judge's decision on that issue.
Whereabouts on that
page? In footnote 10 is where I'm seeing it.
All right, here, United States, on the other hand. Well, I'm not sure where the finding is. Consequently, both the U.S. appraisers and the landowners' appraisers concluded the fair market value was its land value less the cost of demolition. I don't think that tells us anything there, does it?
All right, I may have misspoken. Let me find the place where I... I do have it marked, but I just have to find it. Yes, thank you. Your Honor, on page 0194, the conclusions. Finally, the court finds that none of the tenants have proven a true bonus value to have been included in the condemnation award. The building which housed the leases was obsolete.
But that's not a finding, is it, with respect to what the value is? I mean, he's not saying the value is zero.
I believe he is.
You believe he is?
I believe he is, yes, sir.
Right. Well, we'll have to wrestle with that.
Yes, I believe that's exactly what he's saying. I believe he's saying my perception from the evidence is that the tenants were paying fair rent for the building they were leasing. Mm-hmm. There was no bonus. There was no premium. That's my interpretation.
All right. Now, would you apply the same principle with respect to 12.3 and the other lease? Now, the language there is different. I guess I have two questions. First, from the landlord's point of view, was there a reason why it would be different in one lease as compared to the other? Or are they both meant to deal with the eventuality of a condemnation?
Well, every lawyer or group of lawyers tries to write condemnation clauses differently, and they're a bear to write. I know I've tried many times to write them, and you have to be prescient to be able to foresee what comes up in condemnation. But I think it was a result of just the differential of lawyers and parties.
Well, from your point of view, from the landlord's point of view, what was trying to be accomplished in either 17B or 12.3? What's the overall effort here? What's the purpose of it?
I think the overall effort was, number one, that the tenant, if they did occupy the premises for less than fair rental value, should be entitled to receive the difference as measured by the capitalization of that difference. I think that's what a good lawyer would try to get for any tenant. If you've got a deal on a lease and you're in there at a bargain rate, you have value in your right to continue to occupy the premises. And that value should theoretically be awarded in a condemnation award, because most condemnation awards give you value for the property, meaning the building and the land. It is peculiar when a condemnation award does not give you any value for the building. In fact, gives you a disvalue for the building. It's a case where land values go skyrocketing and no reasonable developer or buyer would pay you anything for the building. In fact, they would deduct what it costs to knock it down. And therefore, the sticks and stones really don't lend value to the package, and therefore, in the award, it is not reflected. I think as to Josephson's, where they wanted to be paid for dollar for dollar for every improvement they put in the package, I frankly think that was an interesting provision. I think had you taken it out of the eminent domain clause and said, look, this has nothing to do with a condemnation award. If anything happens that we're dispossessed from this property, you, landlord, agree to pay me everything I put into it. Doesn't matter when it happens, the last day of the lease. If a landlord wants to make a deal like that, then he's got a personal obligation to do that. I don't think it's in rem. I don't think it has anything to do with the real estate. It's a contractual obligation. And an interesting question is whether that passes on to a creditor who takes this piece of property in a foreclosure.
What about this sub 3, compensation for loss of goodwill to the extent proven by tenant? What was the showing there?
Well, we wrestled with that, and of course our position was, since the 1970s, when California legislature finally gave in to a lot of pressure that the business people were making, particularly in redevelopment areas, where their businesses were just being ousted, it allowed recovery for compensation for goodwill. So all of us that practice in the field did our paragraph, and every lease we wrote said the tenant gets goodwill if he lost it and can prove it per the code. You have to show that you tried to relocate, etc. That, to me, was one of those typical paragraphs. And a clue that they were addressing California law is that later in that same paragraph, they talk about moving costs pursuant to government code such and such, which is peculiarly California. It is the California government code which provides for the moving costs. So the evidence to me shows that they focused on California law. Did they think, well, what happens if a federal government condemns this and federal government does not award goodwill? I don't think so.
Well, it doesn't seem to be limited by that kind of interpretation. It's pretty flat out, isn't it?
Well, it is flat out. And
it shall be entitled to receive the following, compensation for loss of goodwill.
If, I think it says if proven.
To the extent proven, sir.
To the extent proven.
Yeah.
And it's,
I guess my question was, what was the showing with respect to that? What was there an appraisal?
They had appraisal testimony, yes, that indicated a sizable loss of goodwill. But what the judge had to wrestle with here is the second phase of this eminent domain proceeding was theoretically to dole out the award. And he had to wrestle with the fact that the owners did not get, nor did anybody get, a goodwill award from the federal government.
Should we demand for a finding on that?
I think the judge did find that goodwill is not. In fact, he ruminated for quite some time in his decision and indicated that he would like to award goodwill. And finally went through the cases and came to the conclusion, Your Honor, that the federal law just does not provide for goodwill in a condemnation.
And was that wrong?
I don't think so. We looked very hard because...
It
if it were wrong, you should remand because it has nothing to do with the owner. The owner gets no part of goodwill. It's strictly an issue between the tenant and the U.S. government. I still have 5 minutes and 43 seconds, but I think I'm going to, unless there's another question.
There is no court rule that requires you to use all your allocated time.
Thank you. I'm out of gas.
All right. Fine. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
All right.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goble?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think you're getting a good roadmap of this, but I just would like to reinforce the confusion of the trial court by referring to page 2 of our reply brief, which has a bolded quote from the record in which he pretty much lays out what we're saying, and then 10 pages later in the record moves off to something else.
Page 2 of your reply brief?
Reply brief in the Senate, right in the center in the bold. And basically...
what should we be looking at on that page?
This, he's saying that this idea about the building not being worth anything is not something that the tenant ought to bear. This tenant made a contract to protect herself over time, as she paid her rent and improved the property and did good business there and enhanced the property, she was wise enough, or her attorney was wise enough, to put these provisions in the lease as a contract. Now, the judge seemed to be very easily jumped to the conclusion that this building is worthless and it's going to go away. But bear in mind that at the time he was trying the case and he was the visiting judge, the building had been taken by the government and been possessed by the government. It was unoccupied. Who knows how long this building could have gone and serviced this restaurant well in the future, through the end of the lease at least, had it not been for the taking. And my client testified specifically that there was knowledge that this building, this large building, was there for the taking for the government. It was right next door to the existing courthouse. So it was a target. And this building could have gone on for a long time if there was any incentive to do so, but there was a cloud of condemnation hanging over the top of it. So I think the judge was way off base on that one, and I would certainly say at a minimum the matter ought to be remanded. If you look at the decision,
give me the specific rationale to remand is what?
Well, my preference would be for the court to find that there's no need for remand because there was only one appraisal on the bonus value, and that was $469,000, and you award that, you reverse it.
We can't make a finding of fact at this level, can we?
But it was not contested. There was no opposition to it. Once you reach the legal issue that the building, this was a contractual matter, and it meets the requirement, then you can. It's simply saying there is no opposition to this. But there was another point I wanted to make. At any rate,
what was the amount of that showing?
$469,000.
Okay.
Which, again, is a small fraction of the total take that was paid to the owner only. We got the pie here, and the owner took the whole pie home with them. And these people were the cornerstone of this building for many years.
Well, except for the leases, doesn't Mr. Dole have a pretty good argument in terms of the analysis of this from the standpoint of just eminent domain law generally?
Well, I don't know. The leases are what the case is about. I mean, that's like saying...
I realize that.
That's like saying we're going to take away the case. In general, I think it's sort of what I started in the first place. You have two phases. You make the pie, and then you distribute the pie. In this case, we have clear leases on a contractual basis tell us what to do. At least our lease does. It tells you exactly what to do. It says that we get a ratable portion of what the landlord gets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goble. Mr. Berwanger, you have some time.
A few minor points, if I may. First, I would reemphasize that this is a case about leases and contracts. It's not a case about pies or eminent domain law or the like.
Help me recall, the United States is technically a party to this proceeding. Is this still part of the original eminent domain condemnation case?
I think only because Judge Singleton, I think through ancillary jurisdiction, determined to address the lease contract issues and determine the claim made by my clients against the landlord. Mm-hmm. So I think we're an add-on to the in rem proceeding, as Mr. Dahl referred to it.
All right.
Have my client desire to be bound by the rules of eminent domain, half of 12.3 would not have been written. Secondly, as far as numbers are concerned, my client invested $685,116 in furniture, fixtures, and equipment and tenant improvements to make the 4,400 square foot restaurant work. And the testimony, and that was uncontested, and the testimony by my clients, again, uncontested, was that my clients lost $370,000 of goodwill generated by the 12 years of operation at that site, and that too was uncontested. Counsel for the landlord, I guess, posits the issue, well, the extraordinary provisions, as I described them in 12.3, are contained in an eminent domain provision. The reason for that is my client was concerned about the concept of a taking. If my property is taken, if I lose my restaurant, I want to make sure that I have guarantees of restoration of my investment in a provision that deals with what do I get if the government comes along and takes the property. We did not intend to incorporate eminent domain principles into 12.3, rather contract principles to ensure full compensation for my client's investment. And that's entirely proper. There are two other provisions that also bear emphasis that the primary focus of the negotiators of the lease was to ensure that the restaurant either continued in place or had enough money to go somewhere else. 12.2 deals with partial takings, and there the landlord is required to invest the entirety of any award into restoring the restaurant. 12.4 deals with temporary takings, and there my client's required to pay any money into restoring the restaurant to ensure, again, continuity. So these, and 15 again deals with redevelopment. Even though Judge Singleton may have found that the building was old, dilapidated, falling apart, nonetheless, the parties to the my client's lease contemplated possible redevelopment. And they provided for a mechanism to ensure that my client would be compensated should there be redevelopment of the hotel.
Mr. Dole made a comment that all of the parties to the condemnation proceeding had an interest in it. In other words, I assume this was the United States versus the owner of the building, and separately each constituent property holder of an interest in that building. is, first of all, is that correct, that far, to that extent?
I guess interest. We certainly had a real property interest, yes.
But was the value of your real property interest entertained as part of the government condemnation, separate from the lease?
Actually, the lease also addressed that to some extent. We gave up, as part of the negotiations in 1988, bonus value.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an express. We gave that up in return for the other parts of 12.3. Secondly, we did receive $40,000 for the, I guess, Class 2 fixtures, which was compensation provided for by the rules of the road and eminent domain, but had nothing to do with 12.3 and our rights against
the
landlord.
That was a direct government award. That had nothing to do with any claims you might have against the landlord.
Correct. Now, but I do think that the $40,000 is an offset against the payment of, by the landlord, the cost per 12.3. Another point that counsel made was that the contract obligations I allude to may not have passed to the to his client, and that issue is brand new, has not been raised before, and I have 2 seconds, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and this panel will adjourn.
All rise. This court for this session stands adjourned.